ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just 40 years ago, racism was legal in South Africa.
You were a non-person. You were non-white.
I'm Sisonke Msimang. My dad was a freedom fighter against apartheid, and I grew up as part of a global movement to end that injustice. But I don't know much about what Australians did. So join me as I meet the Aussies who took a stand and helped change world history. ABC Rewind, Boycott. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
A world reordered is the issue we've been exploring all this week on Global Roaming, Geraldine, and the Strait of Hormuz poses an immediate and acute question for us.
And where do we as Australia sit within that type of reordered world?
Could it get more chaotic? What do we do if it does? The man you're about to hear from is someone that I know you've wanted us to talk to for a long time.
And he says it's time for us to grow up. No one is coming to rescue us. I'm Geraldine Duke.
I'm Hamish McDonald. This is A World Reordered, and Australia's place in it on Global Roaming. No one's coming to look after us. It's time for us to grow up. That is the key message from David Kilcullen. Who is he, Geraldine, for those unfamiliar?
He is a very interesting ex-Australian soldier, now very well respected in the counterinsurgency military thinking community, if I can put it like that.
Based in the States, highly regarded across the aisle in US politics.
Brings anthropology, brings counterinsurgency specialty. He writes beautifully. He speaks to the community very well. So it's a terrific sort of suite of skills that he brings.
He's also got a role at the University of New South Wales, and he's hosting a summit in Canberra this week alongside Malcolm Turnbull under the banner of sovereignty and security. So to close out the conversation we've been having all week about how Australia finds its plan B or its way forward in this incredibly chaotic world, here he is now.
David, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thanks for having me.
We're all watching the Middle East. I wonder sort of what you're learning about contemporary warfare from watching it, and have we reached sort of maximum chaos and destruction, or is there more to come?
To answer the second part of the question first, unfortunately, no, we have not yet reached maximum chaos. This could get a lot worse and it could go on a lot longer. What I'm seeing in terms of the way combat is going is a continuation of something that we've been tracking for a while, which is that big, single-use, expensive platforms, things like aircraft carriers and big ships and so on, are much less useful now than they used to be. And things like small, cheap drones that are networked, that are easy to replace, easy to build, those things tend to be dominating the battle space. We've seen that in Ukraine. We've seen it in the Middle East until the start of this war in places like Gaza and Syria. And we're very much seeing it now in the Iran conflict.
I did notice that I think it's the Abraham Lincoln, the first big aircraft carrier deployed to the Gulf, has had to go back to the States because of a fire on board the Gulf, the ship.
USS Ford. Let me use that as an example, actually. So the Americans spent about 13 years and $13 billion US dollars building the Ford. It's the most advanced aircraft carrier in their system. The Chinese built a missile, the anti-ship ballistic missile called the DF-26, that can sink the Ford, and they build about one of those every 10 days for a fraction of the cost. So we're at the point where no sensible country is going to risk an asset like a big aircraft carrier where it might get sunk by a much cheaper drone or something like that. So that's the dynamic that everybody's dealing with.
If we were to strip away the rhetoric that we're hearing out of Israel, the US and Iran about these stated objectives, denials of talks, all the rest of it, could you give an accurate snapshot to listeners of what the actual conflict is, what the targets are, what the shape of this actual fight is right now?
So this is a exchange of missile fire and on the part of the Americans and the Israelis of bombs. And although the goals have been expressed differently at different times from the US and Israel, it's essentially to remove Iran's military capability, its missile launching and production capability, and its ability to enrich uranium. That's the sort of primary goal that the US military forces are trying to achieve.
The last of those goals, obviously, the United States said last year it had completely obliterated.
Well, sort of. So there are three subtly but significantly different things here, right? There's the Iranian bomb program to build a nuclear weapon. US intelligence for 15 years has assessed that they don't actually have a current bomb program. They suspended it in about 2004 and haven't restarted it. Then there's the enrichment program of enriching uranium, and that's Israel's main concern. And they, the Iranians, are enriching uranium well beyond what you would need for peaceful use. So that's a concern, right? Like, why are they doing it? Are they trying to get a threshold nuclear capability, what we call breakout capability, where they can quickly build a bomb if they decide to do it? That's what Tel Aviv's really worried about. And then the third one is the actual stockpile of enriched uranium that they currently have. So Trump claimed last year that the Iranian nuclear facilities had been obliterated. What he was talking about was the enrichment facility, the ability to actually continue to enrich. But they're still sitting on, most people think, about half a ton of highly enriched uranium, which would need to be dealt with. But this is where I think it gets complicated, because Israel's objective is quite different from the United States. US wants a quick disruption and then back to normal.
The Venezuelan model.
Yeah.
Take out the top of the snake, get someone in that you can deal with.
I mean, someone I know in the US Congress said to me that the intent was for it to be Venezuela on steroids, but maybe they didn't quite realize how many steroids would be involved, you know? So I think that's sort of where it's going.
Can I ask then, given you have these conversations in the United States, like, it would take reading one chapter on one book about the Middle East or about geopolitics or about the flow of oil and gas in the world to understand how dangerous it is launching a conflict anywhere near the Strait of Hormuz. What did the US think was going to happen?
So President Trump said, I guess it was last week, that nobody knew this would happen, and he himself, you know, was caught by surprise and was told it wouldn't happen. I find that unbelievable, as in literally I don't believe that.
Can I be really blunt? Like, it sounds wantonly dumb.
My first job when I went to the Pentagon more than 20 years ago was to do a war game on a potential conflict with Iran. We do them regularly, like every year. A dozen countries get involved, and it's almost an unarguable issue that if you do that, you end up in a Strait of Hormuz crisis, which has massive global impact. What I think may have happened is that President Trump was listening to a different set of advisors from the folks that know this stuff in the Pentagon, and may have been convinced that this time the Iranians wouldn't move on the Strait of Hormuz.
But which advisors think that's not going to happen?
Well, political advisors.
That, in fact, I heard a discussion with Jack Watling, you know, Joshi, talking about this, and they said the military people did give an advice, warning about this, but they all said that the time taken, which I think is pertinent to what you're saying here in Australia, by political people, they don't act fast. So they haven't grasped, funnily enough, even though they keep saying it, they don't seem to have grasped that there's a new world underway and new types of contemporary warfare, which is why I asked that question first.
Can you just explain what you mean by the timing on that?
They were given the advice last year in about August, after the June 12-day war. They were told that the Straits were likely to be a major problem, and that the military people were quite clear that it was, and the political people didn't hear it. That was the assumption of the military advisors, that the political advisors couldn't act fast enough.
But this is what I don't get. All these incredible military minds that would be asked to execute this stuff, aren't they saying, guys, Susie Wiles, Stephen Miller?
Mm. Well, they say they are saying it.
Pete Hegseth, guys, have you thought this through?
Well, yes and no, right? So we have civilian control of the military, and that's a really important bedrock principle in a democracy. And what that means, unfortunately, is that technical advisors, including military experts, don't get to have their way. They get to share their opinion. And then once that's been shared, political leaders decide on the basis of often political factors. And they also bring into account things like ongoing negotiations, which of course were running up until the moment of the strike. So I think the military said their piece. The politicians appear to have, did not listen. That's not uncommon, actually.
But would they have said, should they have said, if this happens, if Iran responds in this way, we can't actually control the Strait of Hormuz. We can't manage that.
They probably said that. But I would say one of the other factors comes from the Iranian side here. A lot of people, including me, I wrote about this last year, expected the first move of the Iranians during the 12-day war last year to be threatening the Strait.
And so it didn't happen.
They didn't do that. So a lot of people in that conversation in August might have been like, well, you guys have been saying this for years, but we just had a war, the first ever direct engagement of the Iranians, and they didn't do that thing you guys have been saying. So you're obviously wrong. Also, just note, of course, President Trump has a complex and contested relationship with the intelligence community and doesn't necessarily trust what he's getting from professional intelligence people.
What do they call it? Normalization of deviance.
Oh, that's very good.
You took the risk. It didn't go wrong.
Yeah.
When you did the 12-day war, you took the risk in Venezuela. It didn't go massively wrong.
Yeah.
And then you do it again and it goes wrong.
It is interesting. I noted, you know, in some little thing that in the financial pages, that on Tuesday night, the Iran wrote to member countries of the International Maritime Organization saying, quotes, non-hostile vessels mm-hmm. could transit in coordination with Iranian authorities. Mm-hmm. Now, so what does that mean?
Well, what they're doing right now is allowing any ship that coordinates with the IRGC Navy, the naval force of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, to transit the strait as long as it shares various amounts of data and pays a fee to transit the strait. They're not allowing Israeli or American-linked ships, but of course, US and Israel don't use the strait very much. So Indian, Bangladeshi, Pakistani, a number of other ships have gone through there and have recently paid fees in yuan, or recently the Iranians said dirham would be okay. And these fees sound exorbitant, like, you know, $2 million to get through the strait. But in terms of the amount of oil that you're carrying on a VLCC, a very large crude carrier, that's like a dollar markup on each barrel. So it's not actually particularly big. It's an attack not only on who controls the Strait of Hormuz, it's also an attack on what we call the petrodollar, right? The tradition since the 70s that oil transactions are done in US dollars. And the Iranians are very cleverly targeting economic infrastructure, but also economic systems like the petrodollar as a way to generate leverage against the Trump administration.
That's their own neighbours in the Gulf.
It is, yeah. Their own rivals, I would say, in the Gulf, yeah.
You're listening to Global Roaming on ABC Radio National with me, Hamish McDonald, and my good friend
Geraldine Doogue.
Oh, there she is. The conversation on this episode is with David Kilcullen, one of Australia's foremost military strategic thinkers. There are some thought-provoking questions for Australia about what happens if we do go it alone, if we do grow up. Should we consider nuclear weapons, for example?
Your thesis, fundamental thesis, is we have got to work out. We've got to stand on our own two feet. We're not going to be rescued, which goes to how we buy, what we buy in order to do that in defence sense. And I noticed, again, talking about the Straits of Hormuz, it's extraordinary. The IRGC, naval branch, and the Navy, they've got all of these small midget submarines, 29-metre submarines. They've got all these small craft, two-man semi-submersible craft that come in and out fast into all the little, mm-hmm. like a fascinating story, all mm-hmm. the little coves of the Gulf. But it's small, small, small. And here we are in Australia investing billions in these big nuclear-powered submarines. Like, surely we should be investing in that sort of small stuff.
Well, we are actually as well. So there's a second pillar to AUKUS that has all kinds of advanced technologies that in many cases are focused on those many small, cheap, fast, networked kinds of capabilities. And there are firms like C2 Robotics down in Melbourne that's working on small subs. There's a lot of Australian work going in on UAVs, lots of on drones, lots of really smart startups in Australia working on that. And the government has just announced a new investment fund to invest in those kinds of capabilities. So I think this is a wake-up call. I think we're hearing the wake-up call. I mean, I hope we are. But certainly the days of relying on a small number of very expensive, long-to-produce, single-role platforms, you know, those days are gone. And I think Ukraine, again, illustrates the same thing.
But you're arguing, and you're saying this in your remarks, that Australia needs to grow up.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
I would summarise, and this is disrespectful to great Australian statesmen that put it in place in the 1950s, but our policy has been the sort of good doggy foreign policy. We want to demonstrate we're a good dog. We'll get patted on the head, and the master will protect us when people come and give us a hard time. The problem with that, and we saw this particularly in Afghanistan and Iraq, is that if your war aims are to show that you're a good ally, well, on day one of the war, you've already achieved that aim because you're there. So now what? And if your great and powerful friend doesn't actually have a plan for how to prosecute the war and win the war, then you're trapped because you can't leave because that would undermine any of the benefit you got from being there. But you can't bring the war to an end. Like Australian troops in Uruzgan, on their own, were never going to win the whole war in Afghanistan, right? We needed a coalition policy that just wasn't there from the Americans, right? So this Iran thing is the latest version of this pattern. And I think the government now is being much more sensible than we've been previously.
Our government,
saying we're not going to get drawn into this unless there's a clear Australian national interest and an Australian goal that's distinct from just being a good ally.
See, I think this conflict actually raises that question in a very interesting way, in that we are so immediately and acutely affected by the effective blockade of the Strait of Hormuz in a way that conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq didn't actually necessarily affect us quite so directly.
Yeah, I mean, I think we very clearly went to Afghanistan and Iraq for alliance reasons, right? There's no doubt about that.
So to deal with the questions you're raising, don't you need a very clear-sighted view of what national interest is, both at home and in the region?
Yes, and you need a clear idea of what an adversary could do to us, and it's not invading our shores with a amphibious fleet, right? Like, I often hear people say, well, we couldn't defend the whole territory of Australia anyway, so why are we even bothering? Well, you don't need to defend the whole territory of Australia. An adversary doesn't need to come anywhere near our territory, as the Strait of Hormuz illustrates, to shut down the Australian economy and starve people out. I mean, that's not going to happen
because we're such
here,
a trade in open trading economy.
Yeah, we're a maritime global trading nation that has interests globally, and you don't have to come anywhere near Australia physically to disrupt that. We rely on seabed infrastructure and space infrastructure and a whole lot of stuff that you can attack.
So cutting a cable between Australia and the United States or blocking the Malacca Strait.
Yeah. Or putting a missile in the Solomons, you know, all this stuff is, you don't have to come anywhere near our territory. All military people recognize this, right? This is not
So you've got to talk about deterrence fundamentally.
Yes. I would argue, and this is a point I'm making in my remarks as well, that there would be no winner out of a US-China conflict. And the single organizing principle for everything that we do in Australia as a nation for the next generation needs to be preventing that war, right? So making sure that any decision we make tends towards less likelihood of war rather than more. And some of that is military deterrence, but a lot of it is having a good relationship with China as well as the United States, and having a close trading relationships with a variety of different players, Europe, US, New Zealand, you know, elsewhere, that give us resiliency.
But okay, let's take that. Might that mean a pretty significant adjustment in what we think should happen or could happen in Taiwan?
Well, let me ask you, Hamish, what do you think is going to happen in Taiwan?
Having just been there, they seem to be of the view that China's already doing what it wants to do, that it's not going to happen through an aerial bombardment or PLA soldiers landing in the Kinmen Islands and taking that first and then bouncing to Formosa, that there's a sort of dilution of the democratic message in the politics. There's grey zone tactics being deployed constantly, such that there's sort of an erosion of the democratic norms within Taiwan. The economy is seriously weakened. You know, you look at Taiwan compared to the nearest mainland China cities now, and, you know, if I were Taiwanese, I would be asking, why can't we have some of those riches?
Yeah.
So I think it's already happening.
I talk to the Taiwanese as well, and I hear the same things from them. I think they are going to be very affected by the Iran situation, which I'll come back to in a minute. But I think that one of the risks to Taiwan is that President Trump says, why are we confronting the Chinese over this again? If it's only because of TSMC and chip production.
And we've already
Taiwan,
got their manufacturing right, base in Arizona.
We're building it in Arizona. You might get a situation, and I've no insider knowledge here, where they say, you move your chip production to the United States, holus bolus. In return for that, we will provide protection to prevent a military invasion of Taiwan, but we're not going to stop a peaceful reunification.
Because the great fear in Taiwan right now is that they've done this to appease Trump, but it makes it less necessary for the US to actually physically protect
Taiwan. So the Taiwanese talk about what they call the Silicon Shield, and the more you move your production to the US, the weaker that shield is.
We're talking about microchips here, right?
Well, so this is where I think people need to understand the impact of Iran, right? So the total energy expenditure, like the total electricity usage of Taiwan as a country, 10% of that is just one company, TSMC, producing chips. That energy is produced by LNG. That LNG comes almost wholly from Qatar, from the Ras Laffan field, which just got destroyed last week, right?
But why couldn't it come from Australia? It
could. And I would argue, I don't know if they're doing this, but if I was sitting in Canberra, I would be saying, guys, we depend on you for petroleum distillates that help our economy run. You depend on us for LNG. Let's cook up a deal between...
So I know what Jerry wants to get in, but just to close out this bit of the conversation, if our primary objective has to be ensuring that we do everything we can to make sure a conflict doesn't occur between China and the US, don't we actually need to really think through what our position on Taiwan is?
Yes.
And know what we're willing to sacrifice in terms of Taiwan and democracy in order to prevent that broader conflict?
Yes, we do. And I hate to be continually delving into politics because I like to stay out of it, but Richard Miles and Penny Wong, I often disagree with stuff they do, but one thing they did that I really liked last year was when the Americans came and said, you guys need to make a commitment now of your willingness to defend Taiwan in the event of an attack. And our minister said, why would we do that when you don't even do that, right? Like the US policy is still ambiguous. Ambiguity, right? So I think we are acting in a more independent and a more self-reliant way on both sides of politics in Australia. And I think we need to keep doing that. And part of that is asking ourselves, what are our interests as distinct from what's the alliance's interest? Because those things are different.
I think it's your idea about how we have a better national conversation. Wouldn't it be lovely if it was bipartisan? Gosh, that's my great dream.
But Jerry, how do you feel about the idea of becoming a more transactional nation?
Oh, well, you see, I think we have to. I think we've got to learn to walk both sides of the fence. But I know there's a lot of squeamishness in Australia about that. I think that's something we don't see ourselves as doing. That's seen as tricky-dicky, a bit sort of cunning,
isn't that where you end up if you're entering this world of putting national interest first, sort of slightly separating yourself
values
from alliance interests because values are the sort of underlying principle?
Yeah, yes and no, right? I mean, if you look back, and I'm not a historian, but I know historians, if you look back at what really happened in the 50s and 60s when we put ANZUS together and we, you know, engaged on Korea and then we engaged in Vietnam and a bunch of other stuff, Australia actually played a really clever hand in getting the Americans to do stuff for us. At different times in history, people like Robert McNamara and LBJ were extremely unhappy with the Australians for being such tough negotiators on some of the stuff that we did. And, of course, we kept until the mid-60s the option of getting a nuclear weapon ourselves, in part because we wanted to have a bit of leverage in that negotiation. ANZUS was not the Americans imposing an alliance on us. It was us snaring the Americans into that alliance, right? So there's a lot of times in our history where, in retrospect, it looks like we were the good doggy, but in fact, we were playing a really smart hand. And I think we could go back to that without really pissing anyone off.
Should we be talking about a nuclear weapon?
I think people have been talking a lot about nuclear power.
Yeah.
I do think we should include the discussion of nuclear weapons in the mix without prejudicing, you know, because we have treaty obligations and a bunch of other things that would need to be taken into account. But of course, this is what's
happening. A lot of people are walking away from those treaty obligations right now, globally.
Yeah. So you described the Americans as transactional. I was in a NATO meeting last year, and I won't say which nations they were from, but one general said, oh, it's hard to deal with the Americans because they're so transactional. And another guy from a different nation said, what do you mean they're not transactional? Transactional would mean we make a deal, we stick to the deal, you do your side, I do my side. They're not even transactional, right? This guy called it whimsical. I think he meant, you know, unpredictable. And that's a problem. Yeah, capricious, yeah. And so when you're dealing with an ally that is really powerful but also really capricious, it just makes a lot of sense to have your own backups. Now, whether that includes nukes is a whole different discussion.
When people ask you, Jerry, what's Australia's plan B, do you think they are willing to countenance the idea of a nuclear weapon?
No. Look, I'm not interested in discussing nuclear weaponry for Australia. If you want to get a better conversation, I do not think Australians will buy into that. But I think they might buy into, like, we are stricken with anxiety. Part of the problem for Australia is that we're stricken with anxiety about being abandoned, the abandoned
fear
nation,
of
fear of abandonment.
Yep.
And that if if we could grasp that we had more power, which is, you know, I go on and on about, which is what Mark Carney said, middle power nations have got to grasp they have some powers, mm-hmm. not the big ones, I know. Do you think that's right? Do you think that until we can find a way and have politicians who say to us something like, we are more powerful than you think, Australians, mm-hmm. you know, we'll be in this position you're describing?
I do, and I think we are more powerful than people think, right? And I think there's an opportunity here to invest in resilience and self-reliance, mainly not around military capabilities, actually, mainly about other stuff.
What do you mean?
So imagine a pyramid where at the bottom of the pyramid is workforce, health, education, and in the middle is things like energy, industry, agriculture, all the things that produce a power base. And then as you get higher up the pyramid, you get into military capabilities, Navy, Army, Air Force, and so on. When we talk about defense, it often gets down to how many platforms do we want to buy in that defense layer? I reckon actually that our pretty critical weakness is it's further down in the pyramid. We're missing a lot of the middle, you know, manufacturing and SMEs and all that. If you were to say we're going to spend 5% of our GDP on national resilience, everybody would freak out because they'd think you were going to spend lots and lots of money on subs and platforms. But if you said, no, when we say national resilience, we're talking about workforce, education, advanced manufacturing, an actual stockpile of petroleum capabilities, that stuff, right? That is defense. And that gives everybody a benefit. It makes the country a lot harder to push around, whether you're an adversary or an ally.
And there are jobs there, of course.
Yeah, a lot of jobs. And that stuff is all national resilience, which I think the nation can get behind. And if you said what we're going to do is we're going to allocate a lot more money, we're going to start at the bottom of the pyramid, and we're going to solve all those problems first, and eventually we're going to work our way up to defense platforms. Not for a while, right? But eventually we'll get there. By the time you got to that point, you'd be in a much stronger position as a nation to project power. And then it's a different discussion from saying, oh, we need more subs or we need less subs or whatever it is, right? So I think that's the sort of, in an ideal world, that would be the discussion we'd be having.
David, is there a way this war can end quickly? So you can give us a quick answer, please.
You mean, could we win quickly? No. Could it end quickly? Yeah. We could just do a deal and back off, right? My base case, and we're talking here in, you know, end of March, is that it runs for at least another 3 to 4 weeks, and that it ends in not the resumption of traditional flows through the Strait of Hormuz, and it doesn't result in the collapse of the Iranian regime. I think the Iranian regime, noxious as it is going to survive in some form, and I think that they will maintain at least condominium over the Strait of Hormuz. There are many things we could do that can make it worse, very few things we could do that could make it go quicker, other than actually sitting down and accepting some of the Iranian negotiating points, which I just don't think is on the cards. I don't think the Americans are going to accept that, and certainly the Israelis won't.
David, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Well, I know you really enjoyed that, Geraldine.
I did.
I can see you physically.
Well, I've been interviewing him for many years, and I just, you know, normally he was buried deep in Syria or wherever there was a hotspot. You couldn't find him. And to have him sitting here, it was really great.
So look, global.roaming@abc.net.au. Please let us know what you think about all of these ideas that you've heard presented this week on a plan B for Australia, or even a plan for Australia in this more chaotic world. What do you think of the ideas Michael Wesley's put forward, or Rory Metcalf has highlighted, or David Kilcullen? And yes, if you've got specific thoughts on nuclear, Geraldine is the person you need to address the correspondence to.
So sorry to come in and say, no, we're not going to talk about nuclear.
Thanks to our producers, Shane Anderson and Aston Brown. We're back Monday with the next instalment of our Matter of Fact series on disinformation. We'll see you then.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.